Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
What's love got to do with it? Interesting question. On my right here I have Helen Croydon, who really has left no stone unturned in her pursuit of what love has to do or not to do with the human condition. Ukrainian wife swapping, you name it. But most importantly, is that
I didn't
correct?
Actually do the
No, far from it. You are really, really exploring and merging it up. But the important was that your book, which I think has distilled some of that wisdom, Screw the Fairy Tale, is currently on sale and in the shed at the end of the show. Great. That then brings me on to Naomi Golder, who is the first on my left. Now, you are working at Professor Grayling's new outfit, aren't you? The NCH, the New College of Humanities. And you're an ethicist by profession, I understand, Naomi. Well, it'd be good to hear from you. And Anders, you're going to tell us whether, well, Cupid's darts have got oxytocin tips. Is that what you're going to do? So we'll be coming to that a little later. And Anders is your James Martin Fellow, is that correct?
Yep.
To the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford. So that's what we're going to do, and that's who we're going to hear from. What I'd like to do, if I can, when we start out then, is to really kick off with the fundamental question. I'm going to ask each of the three speakers to give me a 3-minute straight pitch on exactly what they have as their answer to the question of love. What is this thing called love? And Helen, I wonder if you could start out.
Well, as much as anyone else, I would love to find my rock, the person who will complete me, my other half. But sadly, don't shoot the messenger. I don't think this person can really exist, or rather, they can exist, but not for very long, for reasons that I will come to. Now, I think in our society and in many other cultures around the world, we're governed by something which I call, in my book, the fairy tale narrative. This belief that if you meet your partner, all your problems will be solved. It's the ultimatum of life. It's the only route to happiness. You can see it in the language that we use. You know, people say things like, oh, he or she, they've had such a bad time of late. I do hope they meet someone. You know, as if that's going to solve all their problems. Or they say, you know, the fact that we use the term settle down. Oh, she settled down now. She's happy. It's almost like that's it. You know, life's over. I have an issue with this for two reasons. One, it implies that our life before we settled down was somehow unsettled. You know, not was it insignificant? And also, does it mean that once we meet someone, the credits roll and that's it and life's over? You know, you see in all the Hollywood movies, it's all about how the boy meets the girl, and then once they meet, the credits roll and it's game over, like they live happily ever after. But what we know is that isn't always the case. Many people can be unhappy in a marriage or in a long-term relationship. Now, love is inherently human. I love falling in love. Who doesn't? It's arguably one of the biggest human highs of all. Who doesn't like that feeling when you meet someone and you really like them and they are the center of your universe? But sadly, this isn't really compatible with either our human nature and our society. And I'll tell you why. Firstly, let's look at anthropology. Some anthropologists have looked at the human mind when it's in love. Now, a leading researcher in this field is called Dr. Helen Fisher. Some of you may have heard of her. She's based in the States. She's dedicated her whole life to studying couples in love in brain scanners. It's absolutely fascinating. When she looks at couples that are in that honeymoon phase of romance, the bit of their brain that's lit up is the part of the brain which is the same area that's responsible for addiction. So essentially, a crack addict has a similar brain pattern to someone who's falling in love. And this explains why we become quite fervent. This explains why people can kill for romantic love. It actually makes us slightly crazy. But you know, but we like it, and our brains are full of dopamine when we're in this stage. But what they also know is this doesn't last for very long. And there are evolutionary reasons why we develop this capacity as humans.
So, Naomi, just if you could give us maybe a brief opener from your point of view.
So, being here as a philosopher, I feel it's important to put forward one of the kind of founding fathers of philosophy view, and that's the view put forward by Plato in many of his works, including particularly the Dialogue of the Symposium. And there we get a rather different view of love. Plato suggests that love is not something that's fleeting, particular, focused only on a particular person and that might disappear the next day, but rather love, although it might be sparked by a particular individual, it might be sparked by a sort of physical draw of their body or something, as Plato would see, ultimately the proper object of that love is eternal characteristics. If you think about it, when you love someone, you would say you love them for various characteristics. I love him for his, sense of humor, for his kindness, for his good looks, whatever it might be, but you cite characteristics. And Plato thinks ultimately what that shows is that you don't love the particular, you love the universal. For Plato, that suggests the proper object of your love is the form of goodness itself, the eternal, repeatable, immutable thing, and that these particular people or institutions or objects that you might see around you that spark that passion are not the proper object of it. And I think that's very interesting because Plato shows that if you really want love to be eternal, you need its objects to be eternal. Therefore, he thought that philosophy was the proper act of love. It's an inquiry into the nature of beauty and goodness themselves.
Thank you. Beautifully put. Anders.
So now I guess my job is trying to reconcile these views, since I'm kind of pretending to be a philosopher and kind of pretending to be a neuroscientist. And it's worth recognizing why evolution produced something like love. Really, simple animals, like a wasp I was watching outside a bit earlier, they don't have love. They have a mating strategy. They have the reflexes and programs to find somebody to have sex with and then produce offspring. But the problem is, of course, when you're a social animal, this gets much more complicated. You need to represent and keep track of your partner, especially if rearing the young is a tricky thing that requires at least two individuals working together. They need to remember who they are. They need to actually figure out who the mate is among all the other seagulls on the rock or all the other mice in the field. So what happened was there was a binding system that developed. At first, in the mammals, it's important, of course, for the mother to keep track of her offspring. And it seems like it was accepted. It was generalized to also keep track of the mate. So those parts of the brain that light up when we see our loved ones overlap quite a lot of what happens in mothers when they see their children. Those dopamine parts are kind of a glue that glues us together and helps us learn how to recognize our partner. Now, the interesting thing that happens with humans is that our kids are really hopeless at fending for themselves for many years. Put any baby in the forest and they don't hunt. It's very sad. They're really bad at hunting. Their parents have to do it for them for years. And that means the parents need to stay together. And that is why we have added a lot of extra stuff. And our big brains allow us to think about our emotions and construct very elaborate cultural structures on top of that. And this is, of course, where we start abstracting things, realize that maybe I don't love her just because of her looks, but because of her sense of humor, or because she's great at Plato. So we create a lot of complications. But deep down, of course, there are neurons firing and chemicals moving around. So it's a giant edifice, originally with a foundation built by evolution. And then we have added stuff on top of it. Some of it universal, because it's in all human culture. Some of it local to your culture, or you, because you just made up that great reason why you're married.
Thank you. And as I'm sure we shall return very thoroughly to explore the stuff on top. But coming back to you, Helen, right at the very heart of it, you said something very profound. You know, we need to maybe let go of a lot of our preconceptions and traditions, some of our romantic stories of love, perhaps. But your research has taken you to some very interesting places. Can I ask you, first of all, how your experience has actually brought you to that conclusion?
Well, it's a case of chicken or the egg, isn't it? Did my research bring me to my conclusion, or did I already have an issue with how we view love as a society, and that's why I did the research? What I think, and what the main reason why I went off and explored all these modern models of relationships, my book, was because I had a real issue with this belief that once you find love, it encroaches on your individualism, and there is this expectation that you give everything for love. Now, I'm not, I'm not being anti-love here. I think love is a brilliant thing, and I want to find it, and it is one of my life goals. But this idea that, you know, there's this expectation that you have to live together, that it will be lifelong if it's real. You know, people talk about a failed marriage or failed relationship if it ends. So it's this idea I think we have in society that a successful relationship or a real relationship has to be cohabiting, it has to be monogamous, it has to last forever. And maybe we should rethink that now in the modern world, because we live such independent lives. I mean, for me, it was just the very thought of giving up my independence and my choice was what made me shy away from that conventional model of relationship.
But can I ask, are there things that, say, happened in your research or in your life that like sort of pivotal moments in that discovery?
Well, they're pivotal moments.
In your field work, perhaps, for your book?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few things which people said struck out to me. So, for example, I interviewed lots of lifelong bachelors, and one guy said to me that he almost got married, and he was engaged, and then he said, one day his parents said to him, you know, it's okay, you don't have to have children for us, you know. And he said as soon as he heard that, he felt this burden being released from him, and he realized that actually he used the phrase sleepwalking into marriage, and he realized that actually that it wasn't what he wanted, but he thought that there was this pressure both to please his parents and everything to do that. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't want to meet someone he falls in love with, but I do think that with our society now, we live much more independently. We are people now in their 20s and 30s are used to having so much freedom and independence that we need to adapt our relationship models to reflect that. And I just had one very quick point. There was a sociologist called Michael Rosenberg who in the 60s was talking about this, and he said, he called something the age of independence. He said we're approaching an age of independence, which he basically defined as people in their 20s and 30s were starting to go off to college, go traveling, starting to have independent lives. And he says this is going to cause a real change in relationships. People are going to start having shorter term relationships because they're becoming more independent. And he was right, and that was in the 60s.
Shorter term relationships, because the hormones are wearing off, Anders?
That might be part of it, but we should remember that even economics affect divorce rates. When women become more economically independent, divorce rates tend to go up. If it's very expensive and socially hard to get a divorce, people actually don't get a divorce. But the interesting thing is, nobody who ever gets a divorce says, yeah, I did that because it was economically advantageous. Nobody ever says that. Well, very few at least. But the interesting thing is, some part of the brain might be reacting to that. And of course, we structure our lives in very different ways now. And it is true that evolution didn't make us stay together forever. We might be getting back to this later, but till death do us part is unfortunately very true if you're living in a cave in the Stone Age environment. Because it's really dangerous. Starvation and tigers and other predators and disease are around the corner. So there was no reason for evolution to glue a couple together permanently, because they wouldn't last more than maybe 10 years. If at that point the kids actually could hunt and fend for themselves, great from the perspective of evolution. And of course the widower would then find a new partner. But now, it's very rare that a big predator eats anybody in a couple in England. Which means that we actually stay together for so long that now our biological programs start running down. The oxytocin levels might be going down over time, and we drift apart. The kind of natural attraction and binding system might actually not be that strong over long spans of time. Not for everybody. There are, of course, beautiful exceptions. People have been together since absolutely forever and they're still just as much in love. But they are exceptions.
Now, Naomi, your research work is in ethics, isn't it? The philosophy of ethics, decision-making and doing stuff. I mean, you know, how can you, could you illuminate what Anders and Helen have said?
In some ways, I feel sympathetic to the suggestion that our current models for relationships are unhealthy and in some sense are not really ethically good, and that we've inherited models of how to live our lives from culture, from the past circumstances that are very different from our own. We probably don't question our morals, the kind of conventional social morality enough. And I think if we did question it here, one thing that we might reflect on is that we actually have various notions of love that are rather different. One of them's more like companionship, one of them might be more like child rearing, one of them might be more like intellectual inquiry, common pursuits of intellectual goals, one of them might be a more lustful sort of passion. And we have somehow got a moral system that expects them all to go together, and that might be something we need to kind of separate out.
Can I add
something
to that?
Please.
That's very relevant, what you say, actually, to what I've found in my research, in that I think we have a drive, well, you know, scientists would back this up, separate drives for romantic love, which is the dopamine-fueled craziness, or the butterflies in the tummy, and long-term companionship, which is mainly when our minds, our brains are flooded with oxytocin, the so-called bonding hormone. Now, as part of my research, I went undercover on a marital affairs website. Awful thing. I don't recommend it. But anyway, it was very good for research. So there I were, donned a fake wedding ring and met all these men who were deliberately setting out to seek an affair. Now, I hated the intentional deceitfulness of them, but I also could really empathize in a way with why they were there. And the most striking thing that I found from these guys that I met, the common denominator which they expressed, was that none of them wanted to leave their wives, none of them were unhappy in their marriages, they also loved their wife, but they considered their home life, their domestic partnership as just that, as like their grounding, they you know, this real close bond, but they still had this separate drive almost for the romantic love. And now I'm not just talking about a sexual urge. They really described feeling like they wanted to look forward to getting to know someone. They wanted the excitement. So I think there is a separation between our drive for long-term companionship, our drive for the excitement of dating and early romance, and then thirdly, our drive for pure sex.
That's very interesting. So just sum up, you seem to be saying then that our current ideas and behaviours that we attach with love are about changing social mores and social cultural values on one hand, greater understanding of the brain as the other, and it seems therefore that love is becoming very fickle. But if we go back to, say, Romeo and Juliet, the greatest love story ever written, some would say, you know, Romeo is clearly madly in love with Rosalind at the beginning of the opening, but within what, one scene? Bing, bye-bye Rosalind, yeah. Hello Juliet. You know, she sees him through the fish tank. Off it goes. So why is love so fickle? Anders?
Well, I think in practice, if you're living in a small community, love might actually not be that fickle because it's going to happen on the stage. It's not going to be done in secret if you're living in a small Stone Age tribe. Everybody's going to know about everybody else's relationships, and they're also going to partially have a say. What happens, of course, when you scale things up to the great city and you can hide on the balcony and in the gardens and so on, is now you get much more individual say. And many of the things that otherwise would have worked against it would perhaps also then they disappear. After all, Romeo and Juliet were terribly immature. It was not just that their families were in conflict. It was probably also that maybe they would grow out of that in a few years. After all, they're both rather young teenagers at the time. However, we have created this environment now that allows us to some extent to be fickle. We have the websites where we can have affairs. We can hide in the anonymity of a big city. And we also have a long lifespan, which actually allows us to... we know to some extent that if it doesn't work with my first marriage, there might be more. So I think that freedom, at least at some part of our mind, is always aware that there could be better fishes around. And that, of course, leads to this problem, given what you said. If we think that the most important thing is to get the best possible mate, there is a soulmate out there somewhere. Okay, she wasn't my soulmate, she wasn't my soulmate. I probably should be trying more and more. So that might be driving a lot of fickleness.
But surely dopamine neurons were firing in the 15th century, weren't they?
Yeah. The dopamine is the thing that makes you fall in love. Do you stay in that state, or do you either go into the companionable pair bonding, or do you fall out of love? We should not forget that a lot of people have unrequited love. It's actually one of the main reasons for people getting into depression and health problems. And unrequited love is a terrible health hazard. it has been for a very long time.
So, Naomi,
is it a symptom or a cause? Well, I'm interested if the unrequited love is a symptom or a cause of the ill health. But anyway, sorry.
I'm fairly confident it is a cause, actually.
Yeah.
It's not the depressed people, they generally don't go around falling in love very much. In general, this might be because they have a social withdrawal. They actually withdraw from companionship, so they don't meet that many people. But I think also that they don't fall in love that much. But a bad case of heartbreak, that has really the same biological symptoms as losing a loved one. It's almost the same brain system probably that gets activated, that sense of loss, even though the other part was never a part of your relationship.
As you can see.
I find that that fascinating, that sense of loss, and I think that it has also been compared with drug withdrawal, because love is considered to be an addiction, really, or the same centres of our brain are activated that are responsible for addiction. I'm quoting Dr. Helen Fisher here, but it sounds like her research is very similar to yours, so apologies for that, but I interviewed her, and one of the things she said, she's the one that put all the couples in brain scanners, and I said to her, what can you do if you have got this unrequited love, or if you are dumped and you've got this great big gaping hole from it? And she said, you'll never know the reason. You've just got to make up a reason and stick to it. And that's the only way of getting over it.
It seems to me what you're saying then, that there are two sorts of love here at work. One, which is actually infatuation or heady, dizzying romantic love. And the other one seems a bit more platonic, you know, something more enduring and infinite.
Well, in a funny way, we've seen the infatuation and then the kind of long-term companionship commitment, that dichotomy. It's hard to know where to put Plato here, because although platonic love, it seems to be, you would naturally, the way it's used in normal conversation, it would be associated with a sort of friendship or companionship. Actually, that notion of eros, so Plato did distinguish between various different kinds of love, but for him, eros, the erotic love, which would be kind of translated now to be the more romantic or kind of infatuated love, for him was the one that led you to this, to turn your eyes upwards to the form of the good. So for him, it was really specifically infatuation that was, fleeting when it comes to people, and so in that sense sort of looks unhealthy in some sense, but actually pedagogically in terms of our development and our own kind of growing understanding of the world and the kind of structure of reality, he thought it was really beneficial and illuminating. For Plato, Eros was had a very special place in his metaphysics, I suppose. It was what mediated between the particular kind of imperfect human fleeting world and the divine perfect eternal world of pure beauty and goodness. And for him, Eros was a kind of passion that is sparked off by something particular. It's something visible, you see a person or whatever, but it leads your eyes upwards towards something that's perfect. And so that's interesting. You've got the infatuation mixed with something that's more disinterested.
In the Middle Ages, they believed that extramarital love was a higher form of love than marital love.
Right,
Marriage was something to be considered too important to involve romantic love. It was strategic, it was about inheritance, it was about building family ties, business ties. Even if you were in the working classes, it could simply be down to where your field is positioned. And everyone had a role in choosing who you married, you know, from the church to local councillors. It was a big strategic thing. And fervent love, passionate love, was considered to be something that you conducted outside of marriage. And there was someone who said, I think it was a philosopher called Seneca, I have no idea how you pronounce it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Great, I've got it right. Seneca, he said, there is no man so dull as a man who is in love with his wife. And there's also, you know, in the church, the sin of idolatry is the act of loving God more than your spouse. I mean, and this was a theme, like, not just in our culture, but across all cultures. So in ancient China, they believed that you shouldn't love your spouse more than your family. That was a huge family betrayal. So marital love is a very modern concept, really.
So it seems then, well, it seems like the Stoics and the Greeks were real party poopers. But it seems to me that you're saying then that this is really unachievable, unattainable. I mean, we're never going to reach the platonic heady ideals.
Well, I think it was meant to be a perpetually unsatisfied desire, because Plato thought, I mean, that Socrates' whole thing was that the one thing he knew was that he knew nothing, right? So he never would know what true beauty and goodness were. But precisely because the desire for perfect beauty, goodness, whatever, would be perpetually unsatisfied, we can never quite grasp it. That's why love is eternal. It's got this impossible object. And in a sense, I think there's something to that.
And it may not be the basis for a marriage.
Yeah, not the basis for a marriage, probably.
Okay, so and actually, it's almost like happily ever after. It's just as unattainable. But here, the point is that it's unattainable. Yeah. Happily ever after seems to suggest that there is an end point and it's perfect. Mm-hmm. Here, at least, you will never reach the end point, and you should be happy that you never reach the end point.
So, can I suggest then that we throw away the end point? We throw away this idea of this unattainable thing and come unashamedly back to the din of the 21st century with speed dating and sleazy gentlemen on datelines and so on. But then just ask, what will happen if we just could free ourselves of this, as it were, this straitjacket perhaps of the unattainable, and we just jumped in the deep end? Bye-bye romance, hello hedonism. I mean, would we be better off?
Well, it depends on what you want to get out of your romance. I think we've seen that we have a kind of triangle here between sex, romantic love, and that infatuation, that intense emotion. And ideally, you might want your relationship to have enough of all of them to leave you satisfied. But there are many very successful combinations that lean more on one side, a corner of the triangle, than others. So I think a lot of our framing can change things. So I have a little personal story to tell. So I'm signed up for cryonics. So when I'm dying, they're going to freeze me, and hopefully the future might find a futurist from Oxford entertaining to revive if they get enough technology, and I'm really lucky or unlucky. So during my wedding ceremony, the priest looked at this one when I was she was giving me the vows to swear. So my vow to my husband is ends, till death do us part, temporarily. And afterwards, my husband, who happens to be a lawyer, pointed out, Anders, you know that legally speaking, you will be dead when you get cryonically frozen, and that actually annuls marriage. And I told him, dear Håkan, no problem, we can try again. I think there is some truth to that. You can recognize that, yes, this might not be until the end of the universe. That's ridiculous. It might not even be to decades and decades. It's going to last as long as it lasts, and you try to be constructive about it. Because the important part of marriage is not whether it's going to end in divorce or in somebody becoming a widow, but actually that you're really happy together now and can maintain that well enough given your situation and your changing commitments and needs over time.
Yes. Lasts as long as it lasts. Interesting
idea. Yeah, I agree. I think
could you imagine, though, a happy culture that lives on that principle?
I think we'd be a lot happier.
I think it'd be better, yeah.
We'd win these contracts.
Please,
you know,
Harry,
I mean, that's just it. A marriage, really, is a contract. And it is something that was founded in a previous era when you sort of had to have a partner in order to survive, and you couldn't live on your own, and we didn't have Tesco delivery. You had to grind your own flour to make bread. You know, you pretty much had to shack up with someone to survive. So now I think we letting love just flourish and reach its natural conclusion, because we do go through stages in life. We're not the same person that we are through every phase. And maybe if we just stopped putting, a time frame on a relationship and stop thinking, is this going to last forever? Could they be the one? Could I spend my rest of my life with them? But just simply enjoying that person for as long as, you know, I think we are monogamous creatures inherently, in that when we are in romantic love, when the dopamine's flowing, we are really just into that person. Well, I am anyway. You know, when you're into someone, you're into someone. Maybe but are we really suited for lifelong monogamy. So maybe we're suited to long-term monogamy and long-term love, but not lifelong love. And just very briefly, there's there are anthropologists who argue that we develop this faculty for romantic love for the time that it takes to raise a child, because in evolutionary terms, it made sense for the parents to stay together until the offspring reached a relative age of independence, which was sort of 7-8 years, and perhaps that's why we have the so-called 7-year itch. And certainly, you know, it does make sense to to be together when you're raising children.
Yeah. Biology echoing real life, interesting. Mm. But you were saying, Naomi, that you felt this could work.
Well, I mean, I do think in general that we should be reflecting on the kind of principles that are handed down to us from previous generations. And one of the principles that you should expect that somehow the relationship is failed if it ends before the end of your life. I think we should reflect on that. And I think what some of the things have been saying today, we shouldn't see that as a failure. It might have been a wonderful relationship, but that doesn't show that it was somehow wrong if it ended. So I think that's interesting. But one of the things related to the kind of platonic vision would be that love fundamentally as an emotion or a passion is, for Plato anyway, was ethically, morally, educational and uplifting. And so love was a force for the kind of general good of society, I suppose, as well as the individual. And I'm interested in if we divorce the notion of romantic love from the kind of child rearing and all that stuff, or kind of let it, may be that somehow it will cease to have this connection with kind of goodness, a broader kind of goodness for society.
I mean, in the course of my work as a psychiatrist, I see a lot of people whose lives have been damaged by the parents busting up when they're long past that period of immature dependence. Anders, what's your view on that?
So I think one of the most interesting things about being in a relationship is that there are two people who are trying to learn about each other on a fairly deep level and stay together despite that. My husband and me have very different philosophies of cleaning, doing the dishes, and Evans organizing files in the network. We're both nerds, and we both have very firm opinions about this. And now we have to negotiate this. How do we organize the file server? What are the views on security? And we need to understand each other, both emotionally and intellectually. And this process, I think, is making us better people, because we actually learn a bit of compassion. We learn to see something from another person's point of view, because we have to. Being stuck with somebody actually has a bit of beneficial effects, which do, I think, rub off on our general social abilities. The problem is, of course, we need to make sure that this learning is constructive. The marriages that last long, they tend to renew themselves. The people come up with new ways of being in love with each other, as well as maintaining the core that actually made them really feel good about it from the start. This might be a bit like a lifespan. We want to live as long as we live, but some people do everything we want to do in life, and then they don't want to go on, while others invent new things all the time. My grandfather, he became 80 years old. He had done everything he needed in life, and he more or less just weakened and died. My grandmother is 106 this year, and she's still pottering about because dying is simply not done. It would upset her social calendar. And I think marriage can be like that.
Okay, well, on that rather heartwarming note, dare I may say that eternally platonic note, I'd just like, if we can, just very, very briefly, if you could maybe sum up your argument in just one pithy sentence.
I think if love was simple enough that we could sum it up in one pithy sentence, we wouldn't be here.
Wonderful.
I think don't necessarily expect all kinds of love to come together. And in particular, if you want eternal love, you might want to consider directing it at an eternal object.
And finally, Heather.
I think we are very lucky to live in an era where we no longer have to compromise the bad relationship to find happiness. We have so much choice now, and it is perfectly possible to thrive alone or with a partner or with a same-sex partner or with 10 partners or to live down the street from your partner, that we should embrace that and not compromise when we don't have to.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. We wanted to let you know that in April we're hosting a weekend on love with debates, talks and workshops. Speakers include Anders Sandberg, Helen Croydon and many more leading thinkers. If you want to join us in the idyllic countryside of Hay-on-Wye, check out our events page at iai.tv.